Mike Binder, let's begin with you. Conservatives and liberals farther apart than they have ever been in modern times. They want to live in different neighborhoods, only associate with like-minded people. They are so far apart that they say that the other party is an actual threat to the future of the nation. Apocalyptic rhetoric coming out of this Pew report. What was your initial reaction?
My initial reaction, and as a political scientist, I think this is my general nature to stand back and take a deep breath for a second and look at maybe not the differences so much, but where the similarities are. And to
you think it's overblown?
I think it might be a little bit overblown. And I think the one thing that needs to be looked at is historically where we rank. And while this Pew report looks back, 20 years or so, and really the changes have come in the last 10, where were we 100 years ago? Where were we 150 years ago when we were shooting each other? You do need a little bit of perspective.
And so this isn't the first time we've had this type of polarization since America was founded. You're just trying to point that out.
Yeah, that's all. A little bit of perspective.
So, Katie, calling in from Politico in Washington, this polarization is reflected in congressional gridlock, something that you and your organization cover every day. The party's now saying people who see themselves as either consistently liberal or consistently conservative now say that they believe the other party is a threat to the nation's well-being. It's a sort of refusal to acknowledge the basic legitimacy of the other party. How do you see that reflected on the Hill?
Sure. I mean, you see rhetoric like that playing out every day. You see it on Capitol Hill. You see it in primary elections, sometimes in primary elections. And of course, as you noted, we have several of those coming up today. I mean, you see people within the same party using that kind of rhetoric kind of further reflecting divides even beyond just the sort of basic left-right split, especially within the Republican Party. But with regard, particularly to partisan divides, you certainly see on Capitol Hill in terms of language that people use about the other side and about the White House, if you're looking at it from a Republican perspective, certainly it's you often don't just see an argument about policy, but it's often, in the context of where is this taking us as a country? And sometimes the language does get a little, apocalyptic.
And let's talk about today's primaries across the country, not so much here in Florida, but seven other states holding closely watched contests. This comes on the heels of Eric Cantor's surprise loss in Virginia. As we talk about Americans being polarized, what are some of the forecasts for these really intensely contested primaries? As you said, in many cases, they involve sort of mainstream Republicans facing off against Tea Party Republicans.
Sure. Well, perhaps nowhere in the country better encapsulates that debate than in Mississippi. Of course, voters are going to the polls on primary day there today. There we have seen a really pitched battle between someone who is thought very much to be kind of in the establishment camp, Thad Cochran, a longtime senator from Mississippi, versus his opponent, Mr. McDaniel, who certainly enjoys a lot of support from what we might refer to as kind of Tea Party groups, both within Mississippi and from across the country. That has long been looked to kind of in this primary season as, one of the places where we might see this battle play out in a particularly clear way, just because it does look to be close. So we've seen a lot of political observers really zeroing in on Mississippi, viewing it as, in part as a test of strength of the Tea Party, which of course has played a key role in primaries elsewhere, especially in previous years. But Mississippi does look to be the site where a lot of people kind of on both sides within that Republican debate are kind of placing their bets.
And we'll go to your calls in just a moment as we discuss the new Pew report looking at extreme political polarization in America. What are your thoughts? The number to join us, 2937. Give us a call. So Peter Schorsch of Florida Politics, formerly known as St. Peter's Blog, a popular political website around the Sunshine State. Let's bring all this home to Florida, a notoriously purple state. As you look at this data on polarization, how do you see it affecting upcoming contests in our state, in particular the governor's race?
I think it's dangerous when either member or either side starts looking at the other side like they're zombies, like that they are literally part of an apocalyptic future for the country or in the state. I think that's dangerous. Obviously, it's not the Civil War, but if you go inside the data, you see that people are starting to make decisions about where they live based on their political views, and that sets up some very interesting election. Like in Pinellas County, where I'm from, we have a multi-billion dollar rail system up for referendum this November, and liberals tend to support it, conservatives oppose it, and that is going to make a decision for the entire Tampa Bay region on whether or not we have the same quality of life, and that is being driven by a liberal versus conservative perspective. We see that same decision being made in Orlando right now with the Orlando-Miami, the all-aboard Florida rail line. And so we see Floridians almost being carved up into different regions based on their political views, and they're almost gathering together like tribes. We haven't seen it reflected yet in our legislative contest, which, as the recent redistricting trial just showed, are the most gerrymandered in the entire country. But we do see it in the gubernatorial race, and that's why there's such intensity between Rick Scott and Charlie Crist. And it's basically because it's a losers leave town kind of race. It is all or nothing. Democrats know that this is their only shot at legitimacy in Florida for the next decade or so, whereas Republicans know that if they can defeat Charlie Crist, there is no Democratic bench behind him. And that it'll probably be the last big race that they will have to fight here. And if they win, they may have control of the party of the state for the next 20 years as they have the last 20.
And so, Mike Bender, as Peter just pointed out, if the gubernatorial is all or nothing in Florida, how do you see this data coming out from Pew affecting that race? Because Rick Scott is counting on Tea Party and mainstream and Republican support, some independents. Charlie Crist, a freshly minted Democrat, is hoping that Democrats will come along with him, but also some crossover Republicans. Will the polarization play out in this race, or will voters cross over?
Well, I think the interesting point about this race, and you hinted at it, is the newly minted Charlie Crist. Do Democrats and the far left view him as one of their own, or do they view him as an opportunity to simply beat Rick Scott? And if you view him as one of your own, then you can start talking about all these deep-seated personal things that the Pew Report talks about and how the polarization really plays out. Do these people get extra motivated to go knock on doors? Do they give a few extra dollars? Do they ask their friends to vote? Or if they view him more as just an opportunity to beat Rick Scott, you're not going to have that same deep-seated hatred, if you will, for the other team. And maybe you don't give as much money. Maybe that Saturday morning you sleep in and decide not to go knock on doors. So I certainly think if Charlie Crist can paint himself and people believe him to be one of them on the left, then that it will certainly help him.
And lots of calls already as we discuss the new Pew Report on extreme polarization in America. With us this morning, Katie Gluick, reporter for Politico.com, Peter Schorsch of the popular state blog Florida Politics, and political science professor Mike Bender of UNF. They're here to take your calls right now. Let's get started at 549-2937. Patricia in Atlantic Beach is on the line. Hi, Patricia. Thanks for calling First Coast Connect. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Great conversation this morning.
And thanks.
I feel that, I'm a libertarian, but I totally understand how the Tea Party people feel, because we see big businesses, they see big businesses getting breaks, and they see all these illegal immigrants taking jobs from lower-level people, and 50% of the people or more are not paying any taxes. So the middle class, I really feel that they feel that they can't support, you know, less than 50% of the country cannot support 100% of the people. And I think that is driving a lot of this. At least that's what I hear from acquaintances of mine.
And that's,
so, that's my comment.
Thank you, Patricia. And let me ask you, though, Patricia, what this report also talks about is that people increasingly only want to talk to like-minded folks. Do you feel that to be the case with your circle?
Yes, I do. In fact, my mother is a diehard liberal, and we have had many debates, and she refuses to budge. She doesn't ever want to meet you even halfway. And like I said, I'm a libertarian. I try to look at both sides, and I do see that people are on one side or the other, and they really don't want to budge. And I think if some of these bigger issues, if we could get some of the corruption out of government, if we could get the borders closed, I think people might come and talk about, you know, the economics and some other things.
And that's Patricia in Atlantic Beach. Thank you for the call, Patricia. Katie Gluick, Patricia talked about immigration, among some other things. Let me ask you quickly, Eric Cantor's loss in Virginia, the conventional wisdom was that it had to do with immigration and that extremely angry and polarized voters wanted him out. Is that sort of narrative hardening in Washington? Is that now the consensus?
Well, you know, that was certainly, you know, and it's a good question because, of course, as you sort of noted earlier, Eric Cantor's primary loss came as a shock to most political observers, you know, certainly in Washington and I think probably around the country, too. The kind of immediate reaction coming out of that complete upset loss was that this was tied to immigration. But as the dust settled, a number of different other explanations emerged, you know, whether it was, questions about how much time he spent sort of, you know, going door to door in the district or, you know, whether his campaign ads actually ended up showing voters that there was an alternative by kind of giving some more name recognition to his challenger, which was actually kind of his challenger's philosophy. So, you know, a whole lot of different pieces of that very surprising development. But you know, certainly people did point to immigration as part of that. Because, of course, his challenger, who's now the Republican nominee, was not supportive at all of taking, too many steps toward immigration reform, at least not before securing the border, whereas Congressman Cantor had indicated support for at least, you know, some piecemeal steps on that, no longer in terms of kind of a broader approach to immigration reform. At least the conventional wisdom suggests that without Congressman Cantor there, that's going to be tough to do, at least in the near future.
William on the South Side. Thanks for holding, William. Go ahead. You're on the air. William? Okay, William, give us a call back. Let's go down the road to Palm Coast. Deborah in Palm Coast is with us. Hi, Deborah. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I've experienced this partisan polarity in my own neighborhood. It's very toxic. When Obama won the second term, my neighbors who have different religious and political beliefs than I, but with whom I've had a wonderful relationship for many years, suddenly excommunicated me from their lives. It's an ongoing saga, and it's ugly. It's really a toxic neighborhood, and that's a big part of it. And it's really sad.
What happened, Deborah? What do you mean excommunicated? What happened?
Well, Obama won, and I voted for Obama, and obviously they didn't. And suddenly everything became political. Even being neighbors became political. So I'm just giving this as an example of how it's trickled down, how it's at the one-on-one level, this polarity. Very, very ugly and very unpleasant to live with.
And that's Deborah in Palm Coast. Deborah, thanks for that call. So Mike Bender, and then we'll bring in Peter. On the one hand, we have a libertarian calling in saying her liberal mother just won't meet her halfway. And then we have a liberal caller saying, my conservative neighbor will no longer speak to me. mirror images of each other.
Yeah, and I think this is really, I don't want to say humorous, but certainly there is something to be said about, we oftentimes we sit here and we bemoan the fact that people don't care about politics and people don't pay attention to it.
But they do.
And here we, and we look at turnout numbers being low relative to the rest of the world, and now we're talking about people caring too much, and people are all way too much invested. And if you make the analogy to football, you know, your favorite team, the Jaguars, if you're a Jaguars fan, you know, the culture of the enemy, the Texans are the enemy. I'm from up north, you know, I'm a Giants fan, you know, Philadelphia Eagles, they're the enemy. And we care, we're invested, and football's a multi-billion-dollar industry. If we're bringing that to our politics, sure, we're going to turn out more and we're going to pay attention more. And the Pew Report talks about the people on the extremes being more invested in the process. But on the flip side of that, then you begin to get these types of outcomes.
So, Peter Shorsha, the data shows that only about a third of all Americans are this deeply engaged to the point where they don't want to act. They literally want to stop speaking to their neighbors if they disagree. But how do you, that third that is so deeply engaged, they tend to drive the conversation, don't they? They are the folks that turn out for primaries. They are the folks that, as Mike said, are willing to go knock on doors, hand out leaflets, man phone banks, and all of that. And that's true here in Florida as well.
It is. One of the things that we're seeing is that since 9/11, people talk about politics 400% more than they did the day before 9/11. And so people... the reason why there's so much polarization is now people are talking about politics more. And so the people that called in, the neighbors who talk about to each other anymore, it used to be you didn't bring up religion and politics at the table, but in fact they are. And you talk about the third of Americans that are engaged more. Well, one of the things that they're able to do now is contribute almost freely. That, you know, one of the things that we've done is remove the aggregate cap on campaign contribution. And so, and then when you talk about the very wealthy getting involved, they're donating at a much more rapid pace. Politico's Ken Vogel had a great story over the weekend about how we're not talking about just a normal increase in campaign spending. We're talking about an almost exponential growth. I do want to say one thing about the first caller, the libertarian. She's on to something. And especially in Florida, where we now have five counties where the Republican Party is no longer the second most popular party. It's actually no party affiliation, the kind of independents that all come together. And one of the things that we're seeing is just such an uptick in the number of people that are joining either the Libertarian Party or are saying that they're NPA. That is one of the biggest dynamics in this upcoming gubernatorial race. I think you'll see tens of thousands of people who have not voted before come out because they're going to be coming out to vote for Amendment 2, the medical marijuana bill. So it's very interesting how people, while they're talking more about politics, while they're polarized about politics, are not finding a home in either the Democrat or the Republican Party.
Interesting. And Peter, do you see the NPA voters who are going to be motivated to vote on Amendment 2, how do you see them casting their ballots for governor?
Well, I disagree with some of the national thinking that says that medical marijuana will not turn out young voters. Nate Silver at 538, the data guy, the data genius, kind of put together something saying that it didn't impact the election as much as people did, as much as people thought. And I disagree. I think that you will see a 2-4% spike over normal rates in an off-year election. Which is probably enough. It is probably enough to give Charlie Crist a very narrow victory at this point, something like 49, 47 or something like that. They are going to be, you know, the Libertarian Party is saying they think that they've got 700,000 people that will be turning out just for medical marijuana this year. I will tell you, working around campaigns right now, I have not seen the level of interest in an issue as I do in medical marijuana. The last time I saw this kind of, I guess, ferociousness was 2009 when healthcare was being debated and the town halls were going on. It is not showing up in the polls, but there are going to be a lot of folks turning out for medical marijuana in Florida.
Mike Bender, you put polls in the field. Do you agree or not?
Yeah, I put polls in the field. And we also, I've done a lot of research on this topic, the role that initiatives play in voter turnout. And he's right. Initiatives that are competitive, that engender political campaigns, can certainly invigorate turnout by a couple of percentage points in off-year elections like we have coming up here. My one caution that this is going to be a huge deal is that I don't know how much of a campaign this is going to engender. The media is talking about it a lot, but there's not a lot of money coming in opposing it. There's money on the pro side, but we haven't seen commercials for it. We've seen the news media talking about it. And also the folks that are most likely to be invested in this issue are the folks that are least likely to generally turn out anyway. So sure, if they all turned out, it would be a boon and it would probably help Charlie Crist, although it's not entirely clear everybody that showed up would even vote for the governor's race, much less all for Charlie Crist. So I think I'm a little hesitant, but it's certainly could have an impact and could boost turnout.
And a wide-ranging political discussion going on right now here on First Coast Connect with Katie Gluick from Politico, Peter Schorsch from Florida Politics, and Mike Bender of UNF. Lots of calls. We'll go back to your calls in just a moment. Meanwhile, lots of tweets coming into the show. Let me read just a few. These are great. Jay tweets the show, "Polarity isn't the problem. It's the lack of understanding about the political process. Both sides have good ideas for good governance." Joel tweets the show, "I had breakfast with a very intelligent attorney businessman the other day, and he told me that people who believe in climate change hate America. That's just weird." And then an email from a listener, "Stop saying there's plenty of blame to go around. We must beware of false equivalence in this issue. When President Bush was elected, Democrats were very unhappy, but they didn't come together as a secret cabal which pledged to block every single thing he did." Katie, this listener reflects the animus people have, where they really do genuinely see the other party is evil and out and up to no good, out to destroy, out to do harm.
Right. And, you know, that, again, as we've been talking about a little bit, is something that's very much reflected in the research from Pew. Those numbers do indicate that, you know, that sort of sentiment, that it's not just that we disagree, but that, you know, the other side is fundamentally, you know, wrong and you know, out to hurt the country. You know, sentiments on both sides have sentiments to that feeling, I guess, have increased in the last couple of years, which, you know, you do see playing out in policy debates. You do see playing out in elections. And so, you know, especially as we get a little bit closer to midterms, we're going to see particularly a pitched battle for the Senate. Republicans just need to net 6 seats in order to take it back. And, you know, Democrats will certainly, you know, want to be standing their ground on those. So I think that you will certainly see people who are kind of invested on both sides of this issue, you know, sort of having those sentiments play out in a public way.
Let's go to Paul in San Jose. Hey, Paul, thanks for holding. Go ahead. You're on the air, Paul.
Hi. Yes, I'd just like to say I can relate to the polarity. I grew up here, and I consider myself a moderate Democrat, but my wife and I, now that we have a son, we're moving, and we plan to go to South Florida, and a big motive for that is because of politics. We want to be in a bluer part of the state, and so I believe in that. And I think one of the keys that, to me, that plays a role is the money in politics, is that you have the far left and the far right, as you said, deeply invested. They're the ones who do all the legwork and invest the money. So the people who are moderate, which are most people, nobody's passionately moderate. People are either passionately right or passionately left. And so when money plays a role in activities, the extremes have the moderate beat, in spite of them being, most people, I think, are probably on the left or right, but to a moderate extent and are willing to listen to others. But in the political world, in the political reality, the way it is now, it's all or nothing. And I think that plays a role in, you know, why things are the way they are right now.
And that's Paul. And thank you, Paul. That's Paul in San Jose. So Peter Schorsch, as you pointed out a little bit ago, people are actually picking up stakes, selling their homes and moving either to another part of the state they live in or to a different state simply because they just can't stand to be around people they disagree with.
Yes, and we're seeing that phenomenon more and more. Although I will say it's kind of interesting right now. One of the data points we've seen, I think it came out last week, is that Republicans are increasingly moving to cities. And the reason why is that across the country, cities are operating by and large better than the suburbs, which have been decimated by the foreclosure crisis the last 4 or 5 years. But Americans see cities like New York and Chicago and Los Angeles, and they see almost a beacon compared to, especially like when we talk in Florida, where do you want to live in St. Petersburg or Orlando, or do you want to live in one of the places where it's been ravaged by foreclosure, by where government services are minimalized, where the tax rates can't even keep up with the cost of living increases for insurance and so forth. And so, like, you look in places like Levy County and Citrus County, where Duke Energy is at, and where the tax base is being hurt by their downsizing. Across Florida, people are having to almost, again, it goes back to almost a tribal instinct to get closer because the politics is turning people off. You see this even at the neighborhood level, at the lowest level, where educated urban liberals are gathering around the university areas where they're coming into, I don't want to say gentrified, but they're there for the redevelopment of the areas. And so it's playing out literally house to house across Florida.
Yeah. And Mike Bender, that to me, and I think to many others, that's somewhat troubling. And the book, The Big Sort, that came out a few years ago, also documented this trend, not just here in Florida, but nationwide.
I think there's two pieces to this. It's are people moving because they hate their neighbors because they're Democrats? Or, as the previous caller hinted, well, we're moving, we want to move to a bluer part of the state. Well, do you want to go to the bluer part of the state because you like the policies that are being implemented such that maybe they spend more money on schools with his new kid? Maybe they care about more public services, unlike maybe here in Jacksonville, where those things have been pared down a little bit. You pay less taxes, but you get less in return. Maybe they're voting with their feet and moving to a place that has better policies that they like.
Let's go to Scott in Mayport. Lots of callers waiting on hold. Hey, Scott, thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning, Scott.
Oh, morning, Melissa.
Go ahead.
Great show.
Thanks.
Yeah, and there has been a lot of insightful comments and tweets and everything were great. But I love talking to people about politics, but if you run into somebody who's listening either to one network, specifically the MSN people or the Fox people, and they're just impassable. They don't listen to a variety of views and aren't getting enough information, it is hard to have a conversation with them because you soon realize it's pointless. And a lot of these are your single-issue people, either your anti-immigration people or your people who want an abortion. You know, they're set. They're not going to look at things objectively. And that's, a lot of it is just getting more information. I would say television news is one of the worst places to get accurate, actionable news to make decisions about politics. You're going to have to get out there and listen to quite a few things, read, listen to different points of view. And it would be nice if our politicians would come up with more of a strategic plan. We do seem to flail about, when one party comes into power, things swing, they swing back and forth. Our country seems to veer. We seem to be swerving down the road left or right instead of looking down the road and deciding what works and come up with a strategic plan.
Thanks for the call, Scott. But Katie Gluick, he mentioned a few factors that drive the gridlock up in D.C. where you are, cable news. Also, you've got gerrymandered districts where a representative's biggest fear isn't the general election but the primary. Often they go into a general election completely unopposed. With these factors at play, it seems that there's really no motivation for the people on either side to even talk to each other at all.
Well, you know, one interesting thing that the report touched on was this phenomenon of ideological silos, where, you know, people, as we've been talking about in this program, you know, increasingly, you know, live in places where they don't necessarily, you know, interact too much with the other side, or that, you know, you can kind of choose your news, as I think the last caller was mentioning. And, you know, if you are conservative, you have kind of a range of options through conservative media, and if you're a liberal, same thing. And so with the rise of sort of phenomenons like that, as well as a district at a congressional level that have become increasingly, you know, conservative or liberal, there's, you know, really not too many competitive House districts at this point, just kind of given, you know, what the maps have started looking like over the last couple of years. You do see very much this phenomenon where, you know, you have parts of the country and, you know, parts of states and even, you know, parts of counties that are very much sort of ideologically bent one way or the other.
And we're getting some fun tweets. Somebody described themselves as passionately moderate a minute ago. Ray tweets the show, "Passionately Moderate is the name of my new adult contemporary soft rock band." Thanks for that. Thanks for that, Ray. Let's get a few more calls. Charisse is on the air. Hi, Charisse. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to. Wanted to speak.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to speak to the idea that, to oversimplify it really quickly, there's three interests involved, and that is corporate America, which is holding our government pretty much hostage, as opposed to we the people. And as long as they play the divide and conquer game, just like in regime changes across the world, the PSYOP's plan is to divide and conquer. That's what goes on in this country. We just keep dividing and conquering, and we the people do not technocratically approach all of the problems. Never mind the attitude behind whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, but look at the matter of fact, look at the data, and technocratically solve it. And you'll find that both parties would agree on almost everything. It is a facade that we disagree on everything. It's a facade.
Huh.
And it allows corporations to control our government.
That's Charisse in Jacksonville. Peter Schorsch, do you agree with that?
I think that that's overstated. You know, what's the biggest, if you look right now in D.C., and Politico does a great, you know, story, has done great stories about this in their influence pages. If you look at the biggest companies in the United States right now, Google, Microsoft, Apple, et cetera, they've had a great deal of difficulty breaking into D.C. and getting what they want. So I think that there's some accuracy to that. Obviously, here in Florida, the biggest companies control some of the policy areas. You know, we look at what Big Sugar, you know, what control it has over our state politics, and it basically gets what it wants. So while it's there, I wouldn't say that they're 100% in the bag. I don't believe that about President Obama. I don't believe that about President Bush, that either one of them was controlled by some sort of corporate interest. I think, I don't know, it sounds a little conspiratorial, having worked in government and worked on campaigns. I'll tell you, I work for, I think, the wealthiest member of the Florida legislature, and I don't think a campaign contribution has ever made a difference to him one way or the other on a vote because of his independence. So I don't know. I just don't think that that's there.
And almost out of time, but Mike Binder, your final thoughts.
I think that this whole conversation is great, and I think the fact that we're having this discussion and bringing people into the fold and talking about it, And I think that the trick is to kind of find that Goldilocks area where people care enough to get involved because it's an important issue, but at the same time, they look to the opponents as, oh, well, hey, we can disagree. And getting to that point is difficult, and it's a really hard balance to strike. And I hope we can get there.
Well, thank you, all three of you, for joining us this morning. Great discussion. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.